Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 16th of August. Yesterday in Washington, D.C., a shooting in the lobby of the Conservative Family Research Council wounded a security guard. On Tuesday of this week, near Texas A&M, a gunman who was being served an eviction notice killed a constable and a passerby. On August 5 in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, the Sikh temple shooting, which injured and killed 10 people. On July 20th, Aurora, Colorado, 24-year-old killed 12 and wounded 58 during the midnight premiere screening of Batman, The Dark Knight Rises. On April 2nd in Oakland, California, a former student gunman shot at people inside a Korean Christian college, killing 7 people and wounding at least 3. On September 6th in Carson City, Nevada, a 32-year-old man entered an IHOP restaurant and began shooting at a table of uniformed National Guard members, killing 4 before being shot dead. And, of course, on January 8 in Tucson, Arizona, 6 people were killed and 13 people were wounded, including U.S. House member Gabrielle Giffords, during an outdoor constituent meet and greet at a Tucson grocery store. This is the reason we're talking about guns this hour of the program, and we thought we would frame the conversation in terms of looking at a history of gun laws in this country. What did the founding fathers have to say about guns? When have we put restrictions on guns in this country? When have we lifted those restrictions? And I guess the question that concerns everyone, because the news is so shocking and so frequent, what is it that we can do as a society to keep people from being killed in these kinds of mass shootings, to say nothing of the shootings that take place that don't make the news as much as these shootings do? We have a guest who knows about the history of gun laws in this country. The first hour of our program today, a professor of law at UCLA, Adam Winkler, is joining us. And Adam is the author of a book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. He teaches constitutional law, professional responsibility, constitutional theory, gun control, and firearms policy at UCLA. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and here is how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always, always leave messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Adam Winkler, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I always watch the news, and I have since I was a teenager, and now I'm pretty old. But it is striking to me the last 6 months or so that we've been seeing, it seems to me, more and more of these kinds of mass shootings. Am I wrong about that? Am I seeing things incorrectly?
Well, there does seem to be a series of high-profile mass shootings. In part, the reason why we see them and pay so much attention to them is because, for instance, the Aurora shooting was just one of the biggest shootings in American history, if not the biggest shooting in American history, with the most people wounded. But we sometimes are distracted by these mass shootings. For instance, 12 people died in Aurora, obviously a tragedy. But about 80 people died that same day from gun violence, either through committing suicide or through criminal acts of guns. So we really should not focus so much on the mass shootings, even though those make the headlines, but more on the ways in which gun violence affects Americans on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get into the history. The restriction of certain kinds of guns, or just gun debate, been something that has been with us ever since the founding fathers put together the Constitution? Has it always been problematic for us?
It has in some ways, although today it's much more problematic because it seems like we can't even discuss the issues without offending the other side. Each side in the debate feels that the other one is determined to destroy America and destroy America's liberties and endanger public safety. So we certainly are stalemated in the gun debate today. One thing I found in doing my research for Gunfight was that while it's true the founding fathers did believe that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms, and that the right to bear arms is one of our oldest, most established constitutional rights, at the same time, throughout American history, we've balanced that right with public safety laws, with regulations of guns where necessary to promote public safety, and we should be able to try to find that middle ground today again.
When we look at the Second Amendment to provide for calling forth a militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, granting Congress that right, this is something that has been interpreted in many different ways since those early years, or is it always interpreted pretty much the same, a broad right to bear arms?
Well, there's no doubt that the Founding Fathers were primarily focused on state militias. The Founding Fathers were fearful of a standing army. Their experience in England had been that a standing army is used by the king, or might be used by the president, to corruptly take over the country and deny people their liberties. So they did not believe in a standing army. They thought that national defense would be best served by a citizens' militia. When we think of the militia in the Second Amendment, it's not the National Guard, it's not the Army, it's we the people, citizens, who, when called out to serve, would grab our guns and be ready to fight in an instant. Hence, we remember from seventh grade civics class, the Minutemen of the American Revolution. About the 1820s or so, courts started to think about the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms more in individual terms, in terms of an individual having the right to defend themselves against a criminal attacker. And it's been pretty consistently understood by the law in those terms ever since.
Let's look at the 1960s. Many people in our audience can remember the 1960s and the horrific shootings during that time. Is it fair to say that the modern gun debate began with the shooting of JFK?
I think it does really stem from the 1960s. One of the things I talk about in the book is that, in some ways, the Black Panthers launched the modern gun rights movement a little bit after JFK was shot. One of the most amazing spectacles in the history of America's gun debate was the day in May 1967 when 30 members of the Black Panthers marched right into the California State Capitol building, openly carrying loaded rifles, pistols, and shotguns. They weren't there to commit violence. They were there to protest a proposed gun control law, and at the time, conservatives in California sought to disarm the Panthers. In fact, the late 1960s saw a number of gun control laws enacted to restrict access to guns, often by blacks, laws supported by conservatives and liberals alike. And ironically, it was these laws that fueled the rise of the modern gun rights movement, laws designed to restrict access by black urban radicals, sparked a backlash among white rural political conservatives who thought the government was coming to get their guns next.
And earlier, were there attempts to keep former slaves from owning guns?
Well, indeed. One of the things that we should recognize about gun control laws in American history is that for much of American history, gun control laws were used for means of racial oppression. The Founding Fathers had racially discriminatory gun laws, barring blacks, both slave and free, from possessing firearms. And America's most notorious racist organization, the KKK, began with gun control at the very top of its agenda as it tried to disarm Southern blacks who had managed to get their hands on guns during the chaos of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how you can get guns now at gun shows, how you can go on the internet and buy a gun. Going back to 1963, interesting article in The New Yorker that relies heavily on what you have written about this. Thomas Dodd, Democratic senator from Connecticut, introduced legislation restricting mail order sales of shotguns and rifles. And the NRA's executive vice president testified before Congress, and I quote, "We do not think that any sane American who calls himself an American can object to placing into this bill the instrument which killed the president of the United States."
Well, that's right. The NRA was not always the diehard, no-compromises opponent of gun control that we know today. The NRA was founded after the Civil War, ironically by a reporter for a newspaper not known today for its support of gun rights, the New York Times. And in the 1920s and 30s, the NRA was at the forefront of the gun control movement, drafting restrictive gun control laws and promoting them in state after state. And in the 1960s, the NRA supported, although with some trepidation, the Gun Control Act of 1968, but that led to backlash within the NRA as well. And in 1977, a group of hardliners who were very much committed to the right to bear arms and to fighting gun control won control of the NRA. And ever since then, the NRA has been recommitted to opposing nearly any gun control law, lest we find ourselves on the slippery slope towards total civilian disarmament.
How is it that we have reached the point, Professor Winkler, where nobody wants to talk about this, when it seems to me as though a civilized conversation about how we keep these kinds of mass shootings from taking place is not particularly controversial? Nobody wants them to take place. We don't want to have hospitals planning mass shooting response events, which we see is taking place in this city and in places all over the country. We don't want to hear about shootings topping the news every single night. It's disturbing. It's unnerving.
That's right. No one wants to see mass shootings. I think, unfortunately, sometimes in the gun debate, it's easy to view the other side's or your opponent's motives as wrong. And in truth, no one wants these things to occur. There's just very, very different understandings about what would stop these things from occurring or how to limit the damage. It's among gun rights extremists, it's very much the accepted wisdom that the best way to limit the damage from mass shootings is to have more people armed and they can fight back. And among gun control extremists, the exact opposite is the case. They believe that the only way to limit the damage here is to have more restrictions on guns. So we have a gun debate where people often agree on the ultimate goal, such as to limit violence, to limit mass shootings, to limit criminal use of guns, but very different attitudes about what strategy will work to accomplish that goal.
Do you think that a conversation about guns should be a part of the presidential debate? And if so, what questions should be asked?
Well, it's of course helpful to think about gun control in the presidential debate. It's an important issue. However, I don't feel we're going to see much debate about that. You know, the Democratic Party has essentially made avoid gun control at all costs an informal plank in the party platform. And I think that's because they're fearful of the electoral consequences of supporting gun control laws. I think there's a lot of Americans, and polls show a lot of Americans support additional gun control laws, like closing down the background check loophole that allows so many guns to be purchased without a background check. However, very few people will actually go out and base their vote solely on that issue. On the gun rights side, people will base their vote solely on someone's support of their view of the Second Amendment. And as a result, you have a lopsided situation where the NRA is thought to be so powerful because it can deliver votes. And the gun control movement is seen as weak because it really can't deliver votes.
In 1994, the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act banned the manufacture, use, possession, and import of 19 types of assault weapons, including AK-47s and Uzis. The law expired in 2004. Why was that law passed, and why did that law expire, and what's been the result of the expiration of that?
Well, that law passed in 1994. It was passed by the Clinton administration. One of the reasons why we don't see additional gun control laws since that time and why Democrats are running away from it is because what happened in 1994 was that Republicans captured Congress, a majority in Congress, for the first time in nearly 50 years. And political analysis, analysts like Bill Clinton himself said that the NRA was responsible for delivering key votes to win the Republicans a majority, which is part of the reason why Democrats have avoided this issue. The assault weapons ban itself wasn't terribly effective. It focused on the cosmetic features of a number of firearms, and the gun manufacturers simply skirted those rules by making the exact same guns, but with a couple of the cosmetic features changed. And so when that law expired, I don't think it really had a big effect on gun violence in America.
Hmm. Why would people buy those guns?
Oh, the AR-15, which is a gun that people talk about as a typical assault rifle, was used in some of these mass shootings. That is like that's one of the most popular guns among gun enthusiasts today. It's kind of like the iPhone of guns. You can put apps on it, if you want to use that kind of analogy, where you can customize the gun. It's really easy to remove it and put different parts on it. And among gun enthusiasts, just like people love to customize their iPhones, they love to customize that firearm. It's also very lightweight. It's really easy to shoot, and it doesn't have much of a recoil for a rifle. And so it's a very popular firearm.
And what do you use it for?
You use almost every single gun that's out there, you use it for target shooting on a gun range. That's where most of these guns are fired, and most gun enthusiasts don't hunt. Most gun enthusiasts don't actually ever have to use their firearm for self-defense. They use it for recreational purposes. They like to go out to the gun range and shoot this firearm. And there are some sporting uses of various kinds of firearms that we call assault weapons or assault rifles. But their primary use, as with most guns, is just for recreation.
Mm-hmm. How many guns are there in this country? How many people have guns?
Well, there are approximately 280 million guns in America. There's no complete registry of guns, so we don't know exactly how many, but that's the current estimates. And about 4 million new guns are introduced into civilian hands every year in America. So the number is growing very quickly. There is almost one gun per person in America, and there is more than one gun per adult.
And when you look at us compared to the rest of the world, are there other countries that have similar rates of gun ownership, or are we unique?
Among industrialized nations, we are certainly unique. We have more guns than any other. And we also have more gun violence. I don't know that there's a strict cause and effect relationship there. I think we have a relatively violent society for a variety of reasons, most notably gang crime, criminal recidivism, and other things. But nonetheless, we do have a lot of guns and far more than we could ever really hope to get a hold of. For those people who think that the answer is to confiscate guns, you can't confiscate 280 million guns. The gun owners will never allow those guns to be taken away from them, and to take them away would be, I think, a fool's errand, because we would never be able to accomplish that goal.
We welcome phone calls. We are having a conversation about guns this hour of the program and looking historically at how we have dealt with guns in the United States from way back in 1791, when the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified, to August 15th of 2012, when there was another shooting, this one at the Family Research Council in Washington. And we're, of course, very close still to a horrendous shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Should things be the way they are, do you agree that you would like to see both of the presidential candidates address the issue of gun violence in this country? And if so, what questions do you think need to be answered? We welcome your phone calls. You can also use the email talk@WPR.org or go to our Facebook page and leave a message there. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Irish Fest, begins today. This afternoon at 5 o'clock on the lakefront here in Milwaukee, we will have a wonderful hour. We're going to speak with a folklorist from County Clare, Ireland, and his group is the Clare Oral History and Folklore Group. And later, bluegrass music is being featured at the festival. We will have guests with us from playing from their new record, Roots of the Banjo Tree. And the American roots music came out of Appalachia, and the European immigrants who stayed there, who settled there, a lot of Irish among them. So we'll have three terrific musicians from We Banjo 3 playing live music for us. This hour of the program, Professor Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA. He is author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. First call is Forrest in Chicago. Hi, Forrest. Forrest, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry about that.
All right, go ahead, please.
Great discussion. I just wanted to make the point that if we take a look at history, we were three times more likely to be killed during colonial times, and that there's been a steady decline in the murder rates in this country since that time, with the exception, if you take a look at Prohibition in the 20s, and then more recently, obviously, the war on drugs, which has really even destabilized Mexico. So I think to take a look at this in perspective, although these events are truly, truly tragic, we're far safer today than we ever were, even with the high rates of gun ownership. And I think that the issue in crime and murder rates, really, the finger goes somewhere else rather than just gun ownership.
Where does the finger go, Forrest?
I think a lot of it has to do, like, taking a look at, like I was saying in the past, if we take a look at Prohibition, what you end up doing is causing black markets and giving people the impetus to go ahead and do illegal activities, like even we see drug sales today. And I think the war on drugs, I mean, 40% of our prisons are filled with non-violent drug offenders that are having to work in really, really bad places. And I think that's probably a much bigger factor than anything else.
Professor Winkler.
Well, that's right. We have to understand our gun violence problem is not primarily one of mass shootings, for instance. About a little more than half of the people who die from gun violence every year are people who commit suicide and use the guns on themselves. And then about two-thirds of the homicides committed with guns are committed by people who are recidivist criminals. If we can control for America's gang and drug problem, we probably find that America doesn't have an unusually high rate of gun violence if we could control for those problems. Obviously, those problems do exist, and they do lead to a lot of violence and unfortunate death. And we should do everything we can to make those things happen less often. But I think the caller is essentially right. When we look at something like Prohibition and the war on drugs, they were both huge failures. They led to huge increases in the black market, more criminal activity, huge increases in the criminal population. When we take things that are widespread, well-loved by many people, and easy to conceal, and try to ban them, we're basically tilting at windmills. Those things will not be effectively banned, and we're just going to make more criminals out of people who are doing things that they love to do and that aren't necessarily, they may have some bad social consequences, but we should be more realistic about how we're going to address those consequences than try to get rid of alcohol, get rid of drugs, or get rid of guns.
I'm going to go back to revolutionary times for a moment. You write in your book that the founders declared that free white men were members of the militia and as such were forced to appear with their guns at public musters where government officials would inspect the weapons and register them on public rolls. When pressing public necessity demanded it, the founding fathers were also willing to impress guns from law-abiding citizens, even if those citizens were left without guns, to defend themselves from a criminal attack. What were those pressing public necessities?
Well, for instance, those guns were necessary for national defense. If we were attacked by Indians or we were attacked by the British or the French, the citizens' militia was expected to show up and serve and to defend the nation. If people did not come out to serve, their guns could be impressed and taken, basically, which is a legal term. Basically, they'd be borrowed by the government. The government would come and seize the guns, use them, and then return the guns to their owners when the time came. You know, it's important to recognize that, you know, the NRA often claims to be the inheritors of the Founding Fathers' legacy of the right to bear arms. But while the Founding Fathers did strongly believe that individuals should have the right to bear arms and wrote the Second Amendment to secure that right, they also had gun control laws. They barred large portions of the population from possessing guns, including slaves and free blacks, and even white men who opposed the revolution. Not traitors, but people who were not willing to swear an oath of loyalty to 13 disunited colonies taking on the greatest military power the world had known at the time. So the Founding Fathers did balance gun rights with gun control and favored gun laws, including mandatory musters and registration of firearms as part of the militia that the NRA's leaders today would never accept.
Mm. Chris in Madison, hi.
Hi, I got a question about the Second Amendment. It seems like the right to bear arms is qualified by a well-regulated militia. How there are millions of people owning guns individually, a well-regulated militia? It seems like we have the Army, the Navy, the police force, and what have you to be that. It just seems like, I guess that's my question. How is that the case? Thank you.
Well, that's a great question, and it's, the Second Amendment is notoriously ambiguous because it has all these commas in it, right? It says a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. It's almost as if James Madison, the author of the Second Amendment, had just discovered the comma and wanted to put it in as many times as possible. If we think of the militia as the founders did, and there's a lot of evidence to support the argument that the founders thought the militia was not a select organized group of people, but a citizens' militia of we the people who would be armed, then the fact that individuals have guns today is part of that idea of the militia. I think we've lost sight of the well-regulated part, right? Now we have individuals who have guns, but they're not designed for national defense. They're not used for national defense, and there's no training or discipline for so many of those people. I still think we can find, as we do with all of our constitutional amendments, even in changed circumstances, find that there are underlying principles in that amendment. And in the Second Amendment, it's two principles. One, that individuals do have a right to bear arms, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, just like they have the right of the people to peaceably assemble or the right of the people to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures in the Bill of Rights. At the same time, there's a second idea of a well-regulated militia, that if we, the people, are going to own guns, there is a proper role for government to come in, make sure that only the people who are not dangerous have access to firearms, and that people who, if they're going to have guns, for instance, out on public streets, can be trained and disciplined so that they know exactly what to do with those guns and don't endanger other people.
Here's an email that's come in from Carl in New Berlin. I think the gun violence is symptomatic of the larger unemployment problem in this country. Adam, do you find those two things to be related?
I think that if one were to do a social scientific study across nations, it would be hard to make that argument. There's a lot of countries that have higher rates of unemployment and low rates of violence. But there's no doubt that on the margins, we do see people who are more desperate might be more likely to commit criminal acts. That seems to be common sense. So I don't think it's solely a question of our unemployment problem. The Aurora shooter was not an unemployed person who was looking for a job and couldn't find one. He was just a mentally ill person who had easy access to firearms and had the madman's tendency to try to do violence to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. What about the Sikh shooter? He had a problematic background, his association with neo-Nazi groups, etc. Evidently, he was able to secure his gun pretty easily from a shop in the Milwaukee area. You look at that, and people do say somebody like that should never be allowed to get a gun. Do we need to make our laws tighter in that regard, or would we be putting undue restrictions on Second Amendment rights if we made it harder for somebody like him to have a gun?
Well, I think that an area where in time we will see some compromise in the gun debate and moving beyond the current stalemate is on the issue of background checks.
Mm.
Currently, we do have a background check system. So if you go to a gun store and you try to buy a firearm, you will be sent through, your information will be sent through a computer database, and it'll determine whether you're a prohibited purchaser, that is, if you're a felon or if you've been adjudicated to be mentally ill or you've been dishonorably discharged from the military. And then if you're a prohibited purchaser, you won't pass that background check. You won't be allowed to buy the gun from the gun store. However, that law has one major gaping loophole, which is if you buy a gun from someone who's not a gun dealer, from someone who's not a licensed gun dealer, then you don't have to have a background check. That's why we hear about the gun show loophole.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real gun show loophole. Gun shows have to abide by all the same rules that everywhere else, but a gun show is a good place where you can go and find just some other person who happens to have a gun collection who's selling guns and can sell you a gun without doing a background check. As a result, about 40% of gun sales in America, lawful gun sales, occur without a background check. There is no reason why we should, today, with our advanced technology, be having people sell guns to other people on the street who they don't know and who might be criminals or who might be mentally ill. We have to do more to make that background check system effective.
DJ in Fond du Lac, hi.
Hello. I was wanting to bring up that back right after the Reichstag fire when the Nazis decided to take all the guns away from the citizens, we see how well that worked out. The year that the article Death by Medicine came out, there was 12,600 shooting deaths that year, but yet there was there's 783,936 deaths due to medical errors such as drug side effects, 106,000. Usually when people buy guns, they go to a shooting range, and people in the area will train them if they see that they are not handling their weapon properly, and then they end up gaining friendships, where if there is a problem, such as we needing to defend ourselves against enemies foreign and domestic, we could end up going ahead and talking to each other and rallying side by side and being like the Minutemen. And so the whole aspect of the well-regulated militia, a lot of the individuals regulate themselves when they own firearms. There are select few that do not, but many of them still do.
Professor Winkler.
Well, I think there's no doubt that one of the things the caller is pointing out is that the vast majority of guns in America are never used for any criminal a criminal act, are never involved in any accidental shootings. One of the things that we say, there's 280 million guns in America, we should recognize how many millions of those guns are never used for any kind of criminal activity. Maybe it's 279 million. I mean, it's a huge number. I'm not very confident that Americans today, if left to their own devices and their own firearms, would be able to combat an invasion by China, for instance. That doesn't seem to me all that realistic. However, whether that's the case or not, hopefully we have other means to defend ourselves. It's certainly true that the vast majority of guns out there are not used for criminal violence. And we should recognize that those guns are here to stay. The question is, how can we put in place laws that will do something to reduce our gun violence? Nothing's going to make it all go away, but maybe we can affect at the border.
The caller talked about people usually going to shooting ranges. What are the rules concerning how to use guns, how to safely use guns? Do they vary widely from state to state?
Well, there aren't state rules about how to use a gun so much. There are some states that have laws that bar you from bringing guns into certain places or from firing guns in certain areas. But with regards to the use of gun, there's the basic rules that every gun owner learns when they go to the gun range for the first time. Hopefully they get a little training before they handle such a dangerous item about knowing that every gun is always loaded, knowing that you have to always be worried about what's behind your target, for instance. There's various rules, but those are informal rules that are passed down through gun training. States really have restrictions on who can get guns, where you can bring guns, and what kinds of guns you can own, not so much on how are you going to use your gun, whether you can use it in a gun range or whether you can use it in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Randy is next in Madison. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. A very good discussion, and it's nice to hear it so calm. I know somebody who I think is potentially dangerous, and just like the Virginia Tech shooter and about 15 others that you've mentioned, mass shooters, there's so much frustration and impotence about what you can do with them. I would like to see, since you've been talking about background checks, that if mental health officials have questions about somebody, that those questions can be consolidated into a report that would show up on the background check. Because it would seem to me that with a lot of these folks, if that information popped up, that's pretty solid red flag.
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the problems with our current background check system, in addition to not covering all of gun purchases, is that the mental health data within the background check system is not very good. Right now, we only look at people who've been adjudicated to be mentally ill. That means a court has determined at some point that you are a threat to yourself or others before you're really entered into that background check. And even then, we have very weak reporting by states, incomplete reporting by some more than 20 states of all the people who are even adjudicated mentally ill. It's very difficult to devise a system that would say, well, if your neighbor has suspicions of you as being dangerous, then you can be denied access to a firearm. Mere suspicion generally is not enough to take away a constitutional right or anything else. If you think your neighbor is dangerous, they, of course, they can do harm with a lot of other things, too. They can take a car and run it into a farmer's market, as we had happen here in Los Angeles not too long ago. So there's lots of other ways. If you actually have to prove that someone is dangerous to themselves and to others before they will be committed or lose access to their rights. That's a basic due process principle, regardless of guns. And so we want to protect that idea, but we should have better reporting of mental health data, and maybe it is time that we start thinking about, are there other standards or metrics we can use for mental health other than adjudicated to be mentally ill?
I want to go back to those gun shows for a moment, because this number of 40% of all gun purchases, there aren't background checks because you're buying it at a gun show or a private person selling one. That seems like a huge number of sales without any kind of check. Why would it be difficult to change that?
Well, the difficulty of changing it right now is that the gun debate is so stalemated. You know, the truth is people on the gun rights side do not want to support any gun control law. One, because they think it's an electoral loser for them, so the elected officials aren't willing to go along, even if they thought it was a good idea. But two, many in the gun rights community feel it's not a good idea because they're afraid that if we pass any new gun control law, it puts us on the slippery slope towards total civilian disarmament. However, when I was going around the country talking about gunfight and talking about America's fascinating history with guns, I found when I talked to gun owners all over the country, they would say to me, we need to close that loophole. We need to do more to protect prevent criminals from getting their hands on guns. Even a perfect background check system is not going to stop criminal violence. But it may have an effect on the margins. It may limit and make it more difficult for criminals to get their hands on guns, and certainly make more people wary of selling guns to someone they don't know or only know marginally because they know that there might be liability that attaches to them if they sell the gun to the wrong person without conducting a background check. So we should have better background checks in place, but there's just no prospect for that moving forward, at least in the short term.
Is the leadership of the NRA out of touch with the base when it comes to some of these controls that you've been talking about?
I think in many ways the NRA leadership is out of touch with the base. The NRA leadership is much more extreme than the vast majority of gun owners. For instance, the NRA opposes efforts to ban people on the terrorist watch list from getting their hands on guns. But if you poll gun owners, you'll find that about 83% to 85% of gun owners support restricting access to guns by people on the terrorist watch list. The background checks that I talked about also supports, the gun owners support that in the upper 70%, even though the NRA absolutely opposes that idea. In one sense, that's not so surprising. The NRA is a political interest group, and political interest groups often are a little bit distant and more extreme than their underlying base, whether the issue is abortion rights or gun rights or any other issue. There's plenty of times in history where we've said the ACLU, for instance, is out of touch with its normal membership when it supports the right of Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois. But that's part of what these organizations exist to do, is to be very vigilant and be on the forefront of defending their rights. Unfortunately, without a good, solid gun control movement to fight back, the NRA's power has been exaggerated.
Well, so what you have, correct me if I'm wrong, is a leadership that's out of touch with its members, and there are a lot of members of the NRA who have an inordinate amount of influence on determining what the debate is, or lack thereof. There really isn't a debate here. So why is it that politicians wouldn't be responding to the rank and file of the NRA and the American public rather than the small number of people who are leaders?
Well, because I think that we often mistake numbers for intensity. In politics, intensity matters more than numbers. I'd rather have 10 people who are really intense supporters who are going to do everything they can for this policy than 100 people who think this policy is a good idea but won't do anything really to make it happen, right? And so what we have is on the gun rights side a small number of very intense voters, happen to be concentrated in the Midwest, in swing states, often some in the South and West too, but then swing states is where they have their biggest impact. In elections where just 2 or 3 percentage points of movement on election day could be the difference between victory and defeat. And those intense people are the ones who are really leading the charge in the gun rights community. Unfortunately, the gun control support is very strong in terms of numbers, but very weak in terms of intensity. So you don't have those, 5% of the people who support gun control who will do anything they can to get more gun control. And so as a result, you do have much more political power on the NRA side than you do on the gun control side.
More phone calls in just a moment. Adam Winkler is our guest this hour, professor of law at UCLA School of Law, and he is also the author of a book that came out recently that received a lot of attention, Gunfight, the Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Irish Fest opens this afternoon at 5 o'clock on the Summerfest grounds here in the city of Milwaukee. It is now the largest celebration of Irish music and culture in the whole country. We'll be talking about preserving the storytelling and the importance of storytelling in Ireland and look at one community's oral history project in County Clare. And we'll also have a live performance from the Irish bluegrass band We Banjo 3. They hail from Galway. So that's coming up. Second hour of our show. Back to phone calls. Chris in Milwaukee is next. Hello, Chris.
Morning. Some years ago on Wisconsin Public Radio, I was listening to a person who was in favor of guns, and I am not. But I heard something that he and I absolutely agreed on, and I want to share it. And that was, in a criminal case, you can plead whatever you're going to plead or plea bargain what you're going to plea bargain, but you can't plea bargain the gun. It means if you're caught with the gun, you have to do the gun charge. It means that people will be, criminals will be less likely to use guns. Remember back in the day they used to put a comb in their pocket? So now we can concentrate on people who are crazy rather than just everybody, because any criminal goes into a 7-Eleven.
Well, the one of the issues that we find with access to guns today is that when you plea bargain from a violent crime and you plea bargain it down, then you might not be deemed to have committed a felony if you have plea bargained it down sufficiently low. What we find is that prosecutors are generally not willing to plea bargain someone who's caught with a gun into a crime that would not stop them from possessing a gun in the future. That is to say, they won't plea bargain them down below a felony. Under federal law today, if you're convicted of a felony, you are barred from possessing firearms. Sometimes that law goes a little too far, actually. We bar people from possessing firearms even if they do something like obstruct justice or commit perjury. So today, Martha Stewart is prohibited under federal law from getting access to a gun because of her insider trading scandal. So sometimes those laws go too far. At the same time, we need to be very vigilant to make sure that anyone who's engaged in violent activity is barred from getting their hands on firearms. And the law is doing a reasonably good job of at least articulating standards for doing that. Obviously, it doesn't prevent everyone who's violent from getting their hands on guns, unfortunately.
Nick in Mackville, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if Eric Holder and the Justice Department did any background checks on the Mexican drug cartels that they pass guns out to, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Right, well, so what the caller is referring to is the Fast and Furious scandal that has led to Attorney General Holder being held in contempt of Congress, and I think that they have recently, just this week, filed a lawsuit against Attorney General Holder on this issue. As many Americans know, the Obama administration sold guns to purchasers who were, they thought, were going to deliver those guns to the Mexican drug cartels, and didn't do a good job of following up those guns. It's not just the Obama administration's problem, in the sense that what the Bush administration had a similar policy, although not nearly as extensive. But there have been a lot of questions raised about what was the idea behind giving guns to Mexican drug cartels and not really following those guns, not making any serious effort to track down those guns and stop them before they got into the hands of the most dangerous people. And so this is a scandal that has been brewing for a while that is, seems to me, only going to get worse. As usual in Washington, the administration, as most administrations do, seems to be more interested in covering up and not answering questions. And as usual in Washington, it's the cover-up that's worse than the crime.
David in San Francisco, hi.
Oh, morning. You know, I was interested in some of the PR aspects and their ability to do fundraising effectively. But I just as a follow-up comment on the way he laid that out, if I remember right, Fast and Furious, Daryl Issa is the congressman from right along the border there. He basically has a district that touches on Mexico. And he, if you pay attention to him, he's got a lot of buddies in the in that little militia that runs around down there on the border. And basically, those guys are dealing with stolen guns. And it's said that the reason why he's hyping this is he's trying to find out if his buddies are being caught up in the sweep. And so it's whether or not Daryl Issa, who is a felon, is misappropriating taxpayer dollars to thwart an investigation of whether or not Daryl Issa's funders are being are smuggling guns down there. So that's that aspect. What I heard, though, the other day that there's a report that recently came out, and it showed basically that the NRA is pretty useless. If they try to scare congressmen into voting their way, basically NRA candidates have as good a chance as a wet cat of getting elected. So, yeah, I wonder if he can comment on the NRA's effectiveness in getting people elected.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Indeed, so many politicians fear that if the NRA comes out against them, they cannot win an election. And that has been proven to be not true. The NRA is not all-powerful. If they were, we wouldn't see, for instance, Barack Obama getting elected president. We wouldn't see, if you think about the Republican presidential candidates, John McCain and Mitt Romney over the last two election cycles, neither of them are big supporters of the right to bear arms. McCain had traditionally received bad marks, bad rating from the NRA because he had supported gun control laws, and Mitt Romney supported adoption of an assault weapons ban in Massachusetts that was very extensive and opposed to the NRA's vision. So it's true that the NRA doesn't deliver votes in every single election, but you can find elections where the NRA does deliver votes, and it's very difficult to find elections where the gun control supporters deliver the votes and win the election. So if I'm an elected official, I say, well, the NRA might have a 50% chance of beating me. The gun control groups seem to have no chance of beating me. I'm going to probably respond to the gun rights groups more than I respond to the gun control groups because they have simply have a larger possibility of affecting the election.
Talking about response, though, to these figures, quoting again from this New Yorker article, David Keene of the NRA says, states this, if you had asked in 1968, will we have the right to do with guns in 2012, what we can do now, no one on either side would have believed you. The idea that owning and carrying a gun is both a fundamental American freedom and an act of citizenship gained wide acceptance, and along with it, the principle it's the right is absolute, cannot be compromised. Gun control legislation was diluted, defeated, overturned, or allowed to expire. The right to carry a concealed handgun became nearly ubiquitous. Stand Your Ground legislation passed in half the states. And in 2008, I know you've written about this widely, in the District of Columbia versus Heller, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that the district's Firearms Control Regulations Act was unconstitutional. Who do you hear saying anything about all of that?
Well, certainly if you went back to 1968, you wouldn't find too many people. The gun rights movement is much stronger today than it was 50 years ago in America. And in fact, one of the things I talk about in my book is how the NRA has really changed. Not only did the NRA used to be a big supporter of gun control, but the Second Amendment was far from the NRA's focus back in the 1920s and 30s when the NRA president was asked to testify in Congress when Congress was considering the first major federal gun control law. He was asked, does the Second Amendment impose any limitations on what Congress can do? And his answer from the perspective of today is shocking. He said, I've not given it any study from that point of view. And elsewhere, the NRA's president at the time, a guy named Carl Frederick, said that the protection for gun rights lies not in the Constitution, but in informed public policy. So things really have changed. In fact, if you look through the American Rifleman, the NRA signature publication from the 30s and 40s and 50s, you'll go through issue after issue, not see a single mention of the Second Amendment. If you look at that magazine today, you'll find it on almost every single page. So the NRA really has radically changed. And as a result, the gun debate has radically changed.
Let's try and take two more quick calls. Dwayne is next. Hi.
Yes, good morning. I think we need to go back to the Second Amendment. Yes, being a constitutional scholar should realize that dismissing the commas dismisses a bunch of the Second Amendment. Each of those commas represent a separate thought, the right of the states, the militia, regulations, the right of citizens, and shall not infringe.
There is no doubt that I think that you could look at them all, those commas, as dividing ideas or as the amendment together as one entire whole. I think that in some ways it doesn't matter how we think of the commas in light of the fact that what the Second Amendment does say is that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And some people have said, well, that's a collective right. That only belongs to states, not to individuals. The difficulty with that interpretation is that we interpret the exact same language of the people having a right to do something as an individual right in the First Amendment. We view it as an individual right in the Fourth Amendment. We think that the Founding Fathers, when they said right of the people to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, were not talking about the right of states. That we think they were talking about the right of individual people. So it would be hard. I think we're hard-pressed to interpret the Second Amendment not to protect an individual right when we interpret all the amendments surrounding the Second Amendment that use the exact same language.
And on that note, we must say goodbye. We're out of time. Professor Winkler, we've had an entirely civilized, calm conversation on a very explosive issue for a whole hour, and I thank you for that. Thanks for the conversation. Professor Adam Winkler, professor of law at the UCLA School of Law, and he has a book, Gunfight, which was released last year and is well worth a read. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this show.